we're about to interview and physical evidence research involving the field of ufology. He and his surgical team have performed 9 surgeries on alleged alien abductees. This has resulted in the removal of 10 separate and distinct objects suspected of being alien implants. These objects have been scientifically investigated by some of the most prestigious laboratories in the world. Their findings have been baffling. Some comparisons have been made to meteorite samples. Dr. Lear anticipates performing yet more surgeries in the future and will investigate the physiological and biological aspects of the abduction phenomenon. He has also formed a nonprofit organization for this specific purpose called A&S Research, Inc. In a moment, Dr. Lear will relate for you the story of the claw. By the way, in the next hour, Richard C. Hoagland is here with some shocking information. Then we're going to have a discussion with Mike Heiser in the hour following that about ETs and religion. That's going to be very interesting. I plan to play the part of a right-wing religious fundamentalist fanatic, and we'll see how they do with me. In the meantime, we're about to hear the story of the claw, delivered serendipitously one day to Dr. Lear's front porch. In a large box, he opened it, and it came directly at him. And he just barely got it off. No, that's not the story of the claw, but here comes the real story of the claw. Dr. Lear, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you again, Art.
Great to have you. We're going to have to treat this, though I know the claw has been under investigation for a long time. Really, this is going to be more the story of how things are investigated the real way when something anomalous shows up. It doesn't happen frequently enough. You know, they go in drawers and closets and they're forgotten and they're never investigated properly. So let's tell the story of the claw.
Well, Art, this is a non-implant case that we've been investigating for some years now. And as far as abduction cases go, it probably has more physical evidence than any case in the books that are on record. And that's why I got interested in it. And I don't mind to say the name because people will recognize it if they've been following so long. So this we're talking about the Gary Lowery case.
The Gary, well, okay, give us a brief overview of that case. What happened?
He's a gentleman with a family who was a fireman, and his job in the fire department was that of an arson investigator. So he was sort of a professional at collecting physical evidence in the first place.
Okay.
He and his family have been involved with the alien abduction phenomena for some years now. And during the course of this, there's been a lot of physical evidence, things that go on around the house, which there's magnetic anomalies.
So in other words, they're victims of abduction themselves.
Correct.
What you're saying, all right.
That's correct. It involves him and the whole family. Now, to shorten the story so we can get basically
yes.
To the point, one of the things that Gary was doing was trying to collect footprints. And he did this in a very simple manner. He took a towel, which was the same color as the rug on the floor, and he laminated a piece of heavy tin foil on the backside of the towel and then placed that down on the floor in front of the wall area where he saw these come through. And he successfully got some footprints, which he casted. So you got one set of prints, why not get more?
That's right.
So he tried doing this for several times and was relatively unsuccessful. So whoever or whatever was stepping on the towel decided, you know, maybe they would step over it or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a few scratches and things, but no more prints. But one morning he woke up and looked at the towel, and he could see a dark object that was kind of hooked in the loops of the towel.
Right.
And so he called his wife in, who had seen him place the towel on the floor the night before,
mm-hmm.
and was aware of the fact that it was clean, there was nothing on it. In fact, she was the one that laundered the towel. So here we have two eyewitnesses to this thing that's caught up in the fibers of this towel. So we took a look at it, and it's an object that's maybe about 3/4 inch long.
Mm-hmm.
And it's dark in color and sort of has a point that goes down at the end. So he looked at it, and he said, this looks like a claw.
A claw.
And got a hold of me. I said, I'd be very much interested in seeing this. So I made a trip up to Bakersfield and looked at the towel and looked at this thing. And by golly, it looked like a claw and it felt like a claw. So here's where it all began. I said, we got to find out, you know, what this thing is, because we may really have something here of scientific importance. So we sent it off, first of all, to the University of California in Berkeley, to the Department of Zoology,
mm-hmm.
and a professor there who was head of the department to look at it, and he couldn't identify it.
He didn't know what kind of claw it was.
He didn't know what it was. So we went back with a letter written and signed by him that said he couldn't find out what this is.
What about the basic, is it animal, vegetable, mineral? I mean, did they do any initial tests to try and find out whether it was biological at all?
Oh, yes. Because the next thing we did was we sent it to my very good friend and friend of Whitley Strieber, Bill Mallow, who passed away last year,
mm-hmm.
At Southwest Laboratories. And again, I don't mind saying the name of the laboratory because Bill's gone and we'll never get in there again.
Okay.
So no sense hiding the laboratory anymore. It was Southwest Labs in San Antonio, Texas.
Okay.
He looked at it, and he looked at it microscopically, and he had a couple of people look at it at the University of Texas, and he ran some tests on it, and in the first place, under the microscope, he found a vegetable layer on the outside of this thing.
A vegetable layer?
A vegetable layer. So he called me on the phone and said, told me what he found, and I said, well, you know, Bill, that may not be too unusual, because if it is a claw or a nail, one of the most common things is they become infected with fungus. So you would find a vegetable layer.
Yes.
So he thought that was sounded okay, and he went ahead and proceeded to do some more tests on the inner layers, and he found that it contained a proteinaceous substance which was very close to keratin. Keratin is what makes up our fingernails. So with that ammunition, we were pretty well convinced
that it was
the claw.
Yeah, it's a claw.
Now, it went from there to a primate zoologist, PhD, at the San Diego Zoo. We took it down there personally, and this kind lady looked at it and pondered over the books and got on the internet and looked at it under their microscope and probed it with a probe and couldn't identify it as any primate claw that she ever saw.
Okay, so now, by now, you're really starting to think you've got something on your hands.
Yep. Now, we could have started tooting horns at any time, including right at then. Hey, guys, I think we got a claw from an extraterrestrial. Ooh, boy. But we didn't do that because that's not the way I work. I try and get some scientific basis. So we knew what we had to do at that point was obviously to look at the DNA.
Right, of course.
So specimens were very carefully taken in the manner at which they should be taken, which wasn't done in the O.J. case. And we sent these sterile specimens to a very, let's say, world famous genetic researcher who I can't mention his name.
Because that's all right.
He's
yeah,
so
that's
famous. And he started doing the DNA studies, and he was funding it himself at the beginning. As we got on to it, the reports that we started getting back were absolutely earth-shocking.
In what sense?
They came back as non-terrestrial DNA.
Non-terrestrial.
So we said, oh boy, we got a tiger by the tail.
But nevertheless, here. DNA, huh? In other words, recognizable.
Recognizable DNA chains, but these chains didn't match anything in the database. Not human, not primate, nothing. So we went on, and as we went on, we had to raise some more money. And if you don't mind me mentioning their names, Bob and Zoe Hieronymus were very, very responsible for getting us some further funding.
No, I don't mind at all.
Nice people.
So you raised more money.
So we raised more money and continued the research with which virtually went on for about 2 years, still getting reports of stuff that we couldn't match for any terrestrial animal. So we had to go further with this.
Yeah, I think by now anybody would have declared, hey, we've got something biological not from this Earth. I mean, once you had DNA, would seem to be, and stand by, folks, because there's more to this, a pretty conclusive hunk of evidence. If you get DNA, but it's not human or not known DNA, you've got it. I would think, but maybe not.
Well, as I said, you know, the temptation was there to, you know, really toot the horn about this and to.
That's probably when I would have tooted.
Yeah. It was a great temptation, believe me. I mean, you know, I certainly believe in the scientific method and scientific approach, but when we get reams of paperwork and DNA analysis that comes back that tells you got something that's not from here, boy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to keep your mouth shut. Mm. Of course, the people that were involved kept saying, I think we should keep our mouth shut. Because the eventuality here was to get an article written in a scientific peer-reviewed journal.
Sure.
And by doing so, this would have been a first for not only phenomenology, but certainly for the field of UFOs and particularly that of abduction.
Okay, so you lip-sealed.
So lip-sealed, and I stopped talking about this case on television, on radio, and traveling about the world.
Yeah, I remember when you began to shut up about it.
Yeah, and of course, you know, you get all the character assassination stuff that, you know, he's hiding something, he's burying something,
mm-hmm.
something he's not going to do. The usual
well,
stuff.
You actually were.
Yeah, it was true. For the moment.
Yeah.
But certainly not forever.
Right.
So anyway, we had to do something to really push this through you know, organized science. And so I got my good friends at National Institute for Discovery Science involved again.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, they've produced some, you know, scientific investigation of this portion of phenomenology, and Bob Bigelow has become quite, you know, famous in the field for certainly putting up funds for these investigations. And of course, now he's branched out in other things with Bigelow Aerospace and so on.
Nevertheless, over the years, Bob Bigelow gets a lot of credit for, you know, being there with the money for the research, the real serious research when people needed it. Over the years, he's done a hell of a lot of that.
You bet. And for those out there that aren't familiar, you know, with the whole story, the stuff and the rumors and everything they've heard, I'm sure you'll agree, Art, that Bob has not only put up money for this stuff, but in many cases, he's put up money and never taken credit for what he's done.
I'm very well aware of that, yes.
So, as far as I'm concerned, you know, they've been very good, good friends to me, and they've pioneered some, you know, fantastic research. The Roper poles, of course, everybody knows, but there's a lot of investigation they don't know about. And of course, there's a lot of rumors that things go into a pit and it never comes out, and so on. So that's far from the truth. As a matter of fact, if folks want to go up on your website or my website or the NIDS website, they'll see not only photos of this object we're talking about, but there's a complete giant DNA report of every facet that we went to. So, again, on with the story. They've got the claw now, the specimens, the DNA, all the data. We have meetings. A plan of attack is formulated, and we start getting some first confirmatory results. If you got something, and you got something that's this unusual, and believe me, it was unusual, what you want to do is to get somebody else to confirm it.
That's right.
So that's the way science works, and if you would stick with the science, I think we'd all be better off.
And so what happened?
So we got some confirmatory data. And then as this was going on, the original genetic researcher kept working on the object, along with these outside sources, and developing new techniques, and looking at this, and looking at this piece of DNA, and on and on and on. Then we sent it out to a third laboratory, which was doing some more work and a different aspect of the DNA, and we were looking at more, you know, primate things. You know, what could this be closest to, and so on and so on. So as this is going on, I mean, we are getting real close now to getting this first article in a peer-reviewed scientific journal.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, we had a big meeting in Las Vegas at NIDS, and it was an all-day meeting. And believe me, I'm not ashamed to say that three-quarters of the material presented at this meeting was way over my head. I'm not a geneticist, and I don't have the background and expertise in this field.
Well, so, even when they go into courtrooms with genetic material, you mentioned the OJ trial, you know, they have to talk in numbers, and they have to make very simple charts for people to try and understand, and even then it goes right over the heads of a lot of the jurors, so it's tough.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, at one point, I felt, privileged to be there and just to sit there and listen to this stuff.
Shaking your head every now and then like, oh, yeah, I got it.
Yeah, man. That's it. And, you know, and they're talking about multi-toss tests and this test and that test.
Yeah. Well, all right, well, let's get to the bottom line, because I do have a lot of other stuff I want to ask you about. I mean, the bottom line here is...
Okay. So we got a plan formulated to what we were going to do is to get this results published in a small scientific journal that was peer-reviewed, and then we talked about the criticism that we were going to get, and we tried to obviate that and so on, one jump ahead. And so things were going in that direction. We left the meeting, and everybody was jazzed, and we thought we had the tiger by the tail on some, very strange DNA. So researcher number one, we'll call him, goes back to the lab, and while NIDS is in the process of writing the article for the journal, my original friend decides to look at the RNA.
Hold it right there, Doc. Once again, Into the Night with Dr. Roger Lear. Doctor, welcome back. All right, the final scratch of the claw.
Yes, we can't leave everybody hanging like a Chad.
Like a Chad.
So, yes, we started looking at the RNA, and of course, that's ribonucleic acid, which is there before the DNA.
Right. So, hey, doctor, do me a favor and back away from the phone just a little bit. Your phone has a sort of a sound to it.
Okay.
There you go. Oh, that's much better.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so you looked at the RNA.
We're looking at the RNA, and suddenly we get a match in the GenBank, a database match.
And?
And it turns out to be in the family of molluscum, a mollusk, a snail, a slug.
It was a slug.
It was a slug, right, so a terrestrial slug.
Oh, boy. And so I'm sure you felt like you just got slugged.
Yeah, I sure did. But, boy, at that time, I was just so tickled to death that I didn't flap my lips.
Oh, yeah.
In the wind.
Oh, yes, indeed.
How would all involved look if we had published this article and someone would have come along with this?
You'd have looked like slugs.
You'd have looked like slugs.
So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. There's the story of what somebody has to go through to investigate something of this possible magnitude. Not a story of one that came out to be extraterrestrial, but nevertheless, that's the kind of thing you've got to go through. So if you've got a sort of a little anomalous something, don't be afraid to get hold of somebody like Dr. Lear or the Bigelow Foundation or somebody who can do the right kind of research, because baby, that's what it takes. Dr. Lear, you have removed implants from people who have been abducted and had things put in them. Are you convinced, doctor, after all, who better to ask than someone who's taken them out? Are you convinced that there really are abductions and that things really are being implanted in people? That's a straight out question.
Well, let's take part one. Am I convinced personally there is such a thing as an abduction? Yes, I am. I've been all over the world and I've talked to people and many, many countries, and the things that they talk about here in the U.S. are the same as what they talk about in South America or in Israel or Czechoslovakia.
And by the way, you know, China, too. That's something not too well known, but the fact of the matter is, while China will not allow a lot of things to be investigated, for some reason, the communist Chinese are actively even encouraging and backing UFO investigation. It's kind of strange.
Yes, they've got the largest organization for the investigation of UFOs in the world.
Now, why would you think that would be, Doctor?
I don't know. It's strange. I mean, given their governmental system and so on.
Yes.
Along with many other things, I have no answer for. And that's what I was going to say. If people come along, so-called experts in this field, and they claim to know the answers, put your fingers in your ears, flap your arms, and run just as fast as you can, because it's nonsense. No one has the answer. All you wind up with, Art, if you follow the science, just follow the science, you'll wind up with more questions. And back to the claw, if you don't mind me just a sec, here's some of the questions. How did the slug get in the towel in Gary's closet?
And lose a claw.
Yeah. How did the slug get mummified to the state in which it was found? Now, we just found out recently, and I haven't even published this yet, that slugs in the Bakersfield area are no longer than a half an inch. This slug was almost three-quarters of an inch in its mummified state. And when we look at the DNA, again, follow the science, we got a 97% match to a slug from New Zealand.
New Zealand.
And a 94% match to a sea slug. How did either one of those get into Gary's
car? Well, maybe whoever it was who had been conducting the abductions had a sense of humor. And you mentioned that it had recognized apparently the towel with the aluminum foil for the footprints, so maybe it just said to its little alien self, hey, let's have some fun. Let's drop one of these New Zealand slug claws.
Or was it something that was on somebody's foot? And fell off. I know I discussed this with Whitley, and he verified the fact that a number of different physical evidence cases showed things that were mysteriously there from the sea.
Well, you've had probably more experience with physical evidence than almost any other investigator, save perhaps crop circle investigators. So of those items that you have removed from people, how many, what percentage of those, only 10, but what percentage are anomalous today?
Well, the total number of the surgeries was 10 to date.
Yes.
And the number of objects was 11.
11.
One of these objects turned out to be a very expensive piece of glass, not expensive from the manufacturing standpoint, from the standpoint of the research to find out exactly what it was.
What it was, yeah.
But the other 10 have all had anomalous things, both metallurgically and biologically. The two most outstanding things are three. One is when you examine the individual prior to the time that they're removed, you found that these objects are emitting an electromagnetic field of about 6 milligauss. Now that, as you know, Art, that's a pretty...
Yes, it is.
Field.
It certainly is.
And once they're out, they emit nothing, so they're obviously unplugged. Then you go look at the biological anomalies. We find that there's no inflammatory response by the body.
Can I just stop you for 1 second? The fact that the radiation ceases when it's removed from the body, would that indicate to you that it's drawing its power from the biological entities to which it's attached, or that it's just remotely, you know, shut off?
I would say that the power source has been disconnected. It's been unplugged, because one of the biological findings we find is that there's not only a lack of inflammatory response, but there's a large number of nerve cells which are not politically correct for the anatomical area that they're in.
So it's modified the nerve structure near it.
That's what it seems to be.
Huh.
And, of course, the other startling things, you know, here's somebody that comes and they allege an alien abduction scenario, and the stories are all great. They're extremely interesting. I love them, love to hear them, catalog them, write them, and so on. But to me, you know, the thing is the physical evidence aspect.
Sure, of course, yes.
So you look at the metallurgy, and, I mean, that information comes back to me from laboratories like New Mexico Tech, Los Alamos National Labs, and on and on and on. And they tell me, for example, they find iron, and the iron turns out to be amorphous iron, but yet the object is so magnetic, they can't understand how it could possibly be magnetic at all when the iron in the object has no molecular structure.
Doctor, is there anything in any and or all of the cases that would lead you toward a clue about function?
Function is entirely theoretical as far as I'm concerned. I mean, there's a number of popular theories. One that could be transponders for location, or modifiers of behavior, or they could be detection devices such as we use with astronauts. But I have another theory, and I think that they are perhaps at least some group of them are genetically genetic detection devices to detect modification in our genetics. I believe, again, that going around the world, I think that the kids that have been born within the last 40, 50 years are not the same human beings.
You're not the first person to say that. Can you back that up with any science at all?
I know that it's possible. I was talking to Colin Kelleher at NIDS. He thinks that we could do a study to look at old DNA versus new DNA.
Yes.
And possibly pinpoint it. All we need is the funds to do it. But, you know, there's a large amount of books that are coming out now. The Millennium Children. The Children.
I know. Oh, I know. Star Children. All
Star Children. The Indigo Children.
Right. Okay, then let's try this angle. What do you think is the difference between these children and my generation? What's the difference?
Well, I can tell you exactly. You asked me if there's scientific proof. There's statistical scientific proof, because they've done a study on 17 functional growth characteristics. This has nothing to do with the child's mood or their IQ or anything else, or what they're wearing or what they ate. It's just, you know, what age did they stand? What age did they raise their head? Which age did they talk? And so on.
Yes.
And we find, looking at 17 functional growth characteristics, and in a 40-year period, 1947 to 1987, they've been accelerated from 16, that's 1-6, to 80%.
Wow.
Now, you can't argue with that.
That is a big difference. Wow.
And how many mothers do you talk to that tell you, you know, their child has done this or said this, and they don't know where to look at them?
So then, doctor, maybe all of these alien abductions and this interaction between aliens and humans, I mean, so many researchers think it's for genetic purposes, favoring them or favoring us, but genetic because of the examination of reproductive organs, that kind of thing. The cows, all of that, the genetics there, all of this perhaps could be to our benefit in the sense that right before our very eyes, they're changing us.
Well, I'll tell you, I tend to lean in that direction, but I hate to use the word all because, as you know, folks like David Jacobs, very famous, well-respected researcher.
Oh, I have a lot of respect for Dr. Jacobs.
Thinks that there's some hybrid program going on, and I tend to agree that maybe this not the word all shouldn't be used because maybe different strokes for different folks.
Well, what I respect about Dr. Jacobs is he's one of the very few people who has said, with regard to aliens, hey, wait a minute now, all this warm, fuzzy stuff, you know, they may not be our friends, and we don't really know, and you've got to admit, we don't really know what they're doing. And so I'd say it's even money on whether it's good for us or perhaps not so good for us.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, and it just goes back to what I said before. If any one of us claims to have the answers, you better put your fingers in your ears and run, because we don't.
Mm-hmm. How many, this is just asking for a guess here, but how many people do you suppose are running around who are implanted, who, A, may not have the faintest idea themselves they've been implanted, and B, nobody else knows as well? In other words, how many are out there that we don't know about versus the ones that have come and complained?
Well, let's look at the few figures that we have from the Roper poll, for example, in relation to the amount of abductees of the 2%. And we're talking about quite a few million people if we multiply this on a worldwide basis. And it would seem to me that in my experience, which is small and brief, that there's about 15% that might be have objects in them for some reason. And this kind of goes along, Art.
Think about it.
You know, what do we do with our implanting lesser life forms?
Yes.
About 15%.
So you're suggesting you do believe that 15% of the totality of the population is implanted?
To the of the abductee.
Of those who have claimed abduction?
Right. Now, also, another thing, you just hit on it a minute ago. If things go the way they're supposed to go, I don't think you're supposed to know you've been abducted.
I rather suspect not, except in perhaps rare cases. I don't think you're supposed to know you are either, and if they're really talented at creating a situation where you don't remember and you don't know, then most of them probably haven't been reported.
I think one of the things that's going on is, as we discussed with the kids, is an expansion of consciousness, and this can become a problem because it can become a problem for the abductor. If one's consciousness is being expanded, then all of a sudden you're going to have a few leaked through memories of things that you may have not been aware of before.
If you were aware, doctor, that you had an implant yourself, would you remove it or would you leave it and see what happened?
Oh, I would have to give you a very biased answer on that because, if someone asked me if, a craft landed and I was waved aboard, would I go? Of course I'd go. All fear would be outweighed by the scientific curiosity. You know, if someone asked me, probably.
Yes, I know, but your scientific curiosity in the case of an implant you knew you had in yourself could be I guess there's two directions for that. On the one hand, you could take it out and try and examine it. On the other hand, you could leave it in and try and figure out what it was doing to you.
Oh, that's good. That's a good question because, boy, that sticks it right home.
Yeah.
Again, scientific curiosity could go two ways. But I think I would leave it in, and if I could get the test done that I thought should be run on it, I would leave it in there for as long as I possibly could to get the most amount of knowledge out of it before it was ever removed.
Yes. Well, you know, the one that stood the hair on the back of my neck straight up was when Whitley and the surgeon who did the work on Whitley were on the program, and the surgeon said straight to me, Art, I got in there, I got near it with a scalpel, and I watched it move within his ear. The implant moved by itself to a place where I couldn't get it without doing damage.
Well, Art, the last case I did was a case of a lady who had an object in the arm that when you touched it, it moved out of the way. And when we went to remove it,
yes.
The surgeon that did it had to put a finger on either side to keep it in the surgical wound area.
Oh, my. Really?
And we got it.
And you got it?
And we got it.
And was it moving after you got it?
No.
No. So I guess all of this is going to remain very mysterious and unsettling. Until we can, I don't know how we move forward in this area, how we learn anything, but we've got to. It's too interesting. Where do you go? That's, I guess, a good question. Where does your research go now?
Well, we've got to raise the necessary funds so that we can keep the fires of scientific research going in the manner that we did with the claw. The claw should be a really good example of how academic science can be applied to phenomenology, ufology, or any other field that you want to investigate.
Well, as you know, I was given a piece of material said to be from the Roswell crash, which we had investigated by Carnegie and others, and is indeed anomalous, not from this world, and I still have it. And it's a kind of an odd thing because when I got it, I really thought very hard about what to do about it. And I can tell you that most people, doctor, are going to just put it away as an oddity and they're never going to turn it over to anybody. If somebody's got something out there and you can bet your bottom dollar they do, and they want to get hold of you to have you take a look-see at something or test something, how do they do that? How do they get hold of you?
Well, the easiest way is to go through my website, which is alienscalpel.com with one S.
Right. And by the way, your book, they might want to read, The Alien and the Scalpel, still out there. Still, I take it, available on eBay or whatever.
Yeah, it should be able to get it. And if they can't, again, go through the website, and we'd be happy to get them a copy.
So one way or the other, they can get it.